I was once treated to a multi-course meal at a very fancy Hong Kong restaurant. Course 17 or so consisted of what I took to be raw fish, and being ever the adventurous Montana boy, I swallowed. Ever since, I've wondered, how can we survive the unfriendly microbes that are out to get us?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 1180th edition of the Food Chain right here on the GCN Radio Network. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in Larnaca who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. Folks, 48 million of us or so are poisoned by the food we eat each and every year, and 3,000 of us die from that poison. Now, I don't think that it's the food that's bad. After all, that food is being eaten by microscopic organisms that's smart and they're hungry and healthy. But the microbes are in no mind to share their food with us, so they slip us a good dose of stay away. And boy, do we ever get the message. I got the message while contending with some microbes for some raw fish in a fancy Hong Kong restaurant. I'll bet those Hong Kong microbes are among the smartest and most competitive anywhere in the world, because when I swallowed their fish, they took me down for days. So how do we go about surviving the unfriendly microbes among us? One of the smartest things we can do is call some of the smartest people we know and ask them. And that is exactly what we are going to do right now. So, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome the co-authors of Did You Just Eat That? We'll start with Paul Dawson, who is professor of food systems at Clemson University. Paul, welcome to the Food Chain.
Good to talk to you, Michael. Thank you.
Good to have you aboard. So a quick way to get the audience to recognize your voice, perhaps you would be so kind as to tell us, what on earth is a food system?
Well, actually, the name of our department is food science, but food systems are an area of study. That is, obviously, the food starts in the raw part of the world, the soil, or grown on the soil, and makes it to our table somehow. So that's going through a system that develops that food or grows that food and then processes it to a form that we can eat. And hopefully we're eating a safe food product at the end.
There you go. And then also with us today, we have Professor Brian Sheldon, who is a professor emeritus of food microbiology at North Carolina State. Now, welcome, Professor Brian. Good to have you aboard.
Thank you, Michael. I'm happy to be here.
Okay, quick question for you. We are told that we are 90% microbiota and 10% human. Now, do they tell us that to just scare the bejesus out of us?
No, I don't think so. It just happens to be the way it is. It's kind of interesting that we do have a significant number of bacteria that either reside on our skin or in our gastrointestinal tract. In fact, it's been estimated about 39 trillion cells, microbiological cells, that live in or on us as compared to only about 30 trillion cells, human cells. So they far outnumber the number of actual cells that we have, but for the most part, they live unobtrusively on us or in us, and in many cases, they actually aid us in, you know, digestive processes. There's only about 1% of the total microorganism biota that actually causes problems. That can be from causing diseases and to spoiling our food. So for the most part, 99% of them are either have no effect on us or actually beneficial.
So when did we come to grips with this fact? How long ago, did we really realize that we're in the great minority? Of the 100% of us, only 10% of us is us. When did, in historical terms, did we actually come to grips with that fact?
Well, I think I'll just continue with the discussion on that. I think it goes back to the introduction of ways to enlarge these organisms. They can't be seen by the naked eye, so the first microscopes that were invented obviously allowed us to see them. And then from that point on, we saw that they were visible with the microscopes, and of course enlarged. And then we came up with ways of culturing the organisms, you know, actually growing them with special nutrients. And we saw, you know, the sizes of them. The more we understood about that they were there, then we developed more and more different types of methods for culturing them. And then we got into estimating their populations. And in fact, on this Earth, there's probably not a habitat that you can find that doesn't have some microorganisms that grow in those climates or environments. And they're very adaptable. They can grow in the hottest of hot, you know, boiling springs, like 235 degrees Fahrenheit, to the coldest places on Earth. Some can grow without oxygen, and others obviously need oxygen. So they can grow at very extreme pHs or acidity or alkalinity environments or high salt concentrations. And but it's actually, when we say it's been estimated that there's somewhere in the neighborhood 5 × 10⁰ bacteria that reside on this planet. That's, you know, that's 5 × 10 with 30 zeros after it. And a very, you know, a huge population of organisms, but it's only estimated that we can only culture about 50% of them. So this number actually may be much higher than what's been estimated up to this point.
So in essence, we live in a rock floating in space. It's just covered with life that we can't see.
That's true.
Wow. Well, Paul Dawson, how did the two of you, professors of this world, come about to write a book called Did You Just Eat That?
Well, Brian and I go back 20, 30 years. Actually, I was his PhD student back at NC State back before the turn of the century, oddly enough.
It's not that long. It's not that long ago.
But anyway, that's how we crossed paths initially. Then I went on to come here to Clemson University in South Carolina, which is not that far from where NC State is located. But we started doing research in these areas with a undergraduate program here at Clemson called Creative Inquiry, where we got the objective is to really look at students, learn how to do research. We picked topics that were very interesting, we thought, to the students, and it turns out they were very interesting to the students, not only the students, but also the public. And again, we published these studies in journals and then got some public interest into those publications, and then got the idea of writing a book, and over several years compiled these into a book. Yeah, so we ended up with a book on Did You Just Eat That?
So, you know, some of the things that you tackled were really great ways of bringing students into the world of science. So here you have a situation. Let's look at it from a scientific perspective. So you take them into the lab, and then you teach them how to do scientific inquiry. And they go, oh, this is fun. Is that the way it went?
Right. Exactly. That's exactly
what
it.
What a great gift for kids.
And then along the way, we hope with this book, we kind of, as you tell by the title, it's there is some science, but it's kind of tongue-in-cheek. We hope that the general public also picks up on, you know, common sense ways to try to prevent themselves from getting sick or spread disease. So that's exactly what you said is exactly right.
Okay.
Just applying the scientific principle to simple everyday topics.
So I have to ask the both of you, both Professor Paul Dawson and Brian Shelton, who study this stuff forever and ever and ever. Have you ever contracted food poisoning yourselves, Paul?
Well, yes, I have. I have, yes. Paul.
Brian?
Yes, I have, unfortunately. But as I always say, and Paul and I both say when we have an opportunity to speak, even though we may have contracted it, you know, once or more in our lifetime, we most of us generally have three meals a day, 365 days a year, and we don't get sick. We don't want to get out there and scare everybody. But again, you've quoted it early on, is that somewhere in the neighborhood of 48 million cases of foodborne illness are reported or are estimated each year by Centers for Disease Control. unfortunately, many of these cases never make it to the doctor because people oftentimes think that, you know, it's just the 24-hour flu bug.
Or right. So it's out there. It's endemic, and we're all going to get it. And when we come back, we're going to find out some of the things that you've learned on how not to get it. This is The Food Chain. Stay tuned.
What's eating what on The Food Chain with Michael Olson.
And isn't that what happens when we eat the wrong things? We get that. I know when I ate that fish in Hong Kong, I knew within like 1 second that I was toast. For some reason, I just knew it, and I was. So you divided up your book of exploration in several different formats, and the first one is called Microbes on Surfaces. What led you to that one? Paul, let's start with you.
Yeah, came up in one of our early studies because we always heard the 5-second rule or the 10-second rule or every second rule you want to call it, is if you drop food on the floor and pick it up quickly enough, you can eat it and it's safe.
I never did believe it, but I still went with it anyway.
Yeah, a lot of these, like Brian, we have said before, that these a lot of these studies we did, we kind of knew the answer. But the other hand was, we wanted to put numbers to that, do an actual scientific study to address that. And so, yeah, that's the first one we did on surfaces, was the 5-second rule.
Well, that's a very common thing. We drop some food and we think, oh, quick, grab it and eat it, and it'll be okay. So how did tell us about your experiment and what did you find?
Yeah, in this case, there's really the neat thing is you get into these studies and there's really different hypotheses that can be addressed or different ways to answer these. And one question, as I mentioned, can be stated: if you drop food on the surface, it's safe to eat. And pick it up quickly, is it safe to eat? On the other hand, the question we address is: if you drop food on a contaminated surface and pick it up quickly at a different time, it stays at different times, is it safe to eat? So those are really two different questions, and some studies have been done addressing those. So we went to the home supply store first and bought carpet, hardwood, floor sample, and tile, took them to the lab, inoculated them with salmonella, and then dropped bologna or bread on those surfaces, and then picked it up in 5 seconds, 30 seconds, or 30 seconds, and measured how much bacteria was transferred. So it's pretty straightforward evaluation in doing that. We also, compounding that, I guess, theory is that we left the bacteria, left the surface there for different periods of time, and then dropped the food on there and picked it up and saw the effects of that. So, again, pretty straightforward. Most people, there is a real concern as far as cross-contamination, because someone could go make a sandwich with raw meat, uncooked meat on a surface, or food there and then leave, and someone go behind them and not realize that surface was contaminated because, like Brian said, you can't see the bacteria. Make a salad or something else, and this actually happens. And that's one time I got sick. That actually did happen, I believe. It's transferred to the raw food, and then you eat it.
You know, you just ruined me because when I read this account in your book this morning, I put a spoon on my kitchen counter, and then I thought, oh, no, you can't do that anymore. Because you don't know what was there before, right?
Well, I guess if it's your counter, you might know if it's there. But if someone else has been there before, you may not know.
You don't know. So what exactly did you find, Brian, when you examined this 5-second rule?
Well, essentially, it's an almost instantaneous transfer. I mean, we elected that 5 seconds would be our starting time, but basically we elected that because it's almost impossible to drop it and, you know, pick it up within a second or two. So we settled for 5 seconds, 30, and 60 seconds. And in fact, after 5 seconds, there was already transfer of the salmonella onto the bologna and the white bread. Of course, the longer the contact between the surface and our food sample, the larger the population. But in fact, if you ask the question, would it be safe? No, it would not be safe after 5 seconds. I say that, would it not be safe? I say the question is you know, some people could eat that bologna and not get sick. It really comes down to the population of organisms that are actually transferred.
Are they good guys or bad guys? And how do you know?
Yes.
Can't see them.
And your immunity, you don't know. So it's kind of, there's a probability or risk associated with any of our actions. And it may be a low probability or a risk that we're going to get sick, but it's not a 0%. And if you happen to be, you know, a very elderly person or a very young person or have a, you know, immunocompromised system, such as you've had a heart transplant and you're on rejection medications, you're going to be more susceptible to it.
Right. You have to be very careful. Well, one of the things I've always wondered about is when I go out to eat, they hand me a menu and I pick it up in my hands and then I got to thinking, I wonder how many other people have held this menu recently. Paul?
Probably everybody works there and a lot of people who went before you. But this study was interesting because this is a good example of kind of a two-phase or two different ways to approach our studies here we did. And that is we went out and sampled randomly menus in the area around the university.
So you sent the kids out. You sent your students out, right?
Yeah, and, you know, it kind of was clandestine because you're there with a whole swabbing restaurant menu. They might get suspicious, but they leave the health department. But that's one phase. We ran out and randomly sampled, menus. And, of course, the variation when you do something like that is large. So that gives you an idea, is there bacteria there? And we found it there and actually categorized the restaurants. And again, this is just specific to our area, so we could draw no widespread conclusion. But we did find differences in the area as far as the type of restaurant and the level of bacteria.
Okay, what was the worst? The worst kind of restaurant?
Well, in our area, it happened to be a Mexican restaurant.
Uh-huh.
But again, I don't want to. The second worst was actually what we categorized as kind of an upscale restaurant, not your. And we categorized them as a pub or a pizzeria or a steakhouse or an upscale, more upscale. And the upscale was as high and close to the Mexican restaurant. And again, that's just in our area. And we actually also measured for staff and found high levels of staff. And staff is a common, you know, hand,
sure,
Especially with skin, and also can be a pathogenic bacteria. So, and then the second phase of that is we actually wanted to know if we went back to the lab and inoculated, you know, mock menus, we'd sterilized and then saw how much was transferred when you handled them. And so, again, in two phases, we went out and randomly sampled and then came back to the lab and did a controlled study. And that kind of is a theme through many of the studies we did.
And what was the reaction of the students when they actually saw what was on the menu?
Much like what you just mentioned when your intro, you thought about it more when you go and wonder. And again, you don't know who's handled it. And probably, Brian said, the real risk is probably low. But if you can mitigate that risk, why take a chance, I guess, is the other approach.
And then...
I'm sorry, I was going to say, could I add a little bit?
Or go, please do. Please do.
I just put it in perspective a little bit. You know, our culture is, we like to eat out a lot. But on a daily basis, about 40% of our population do eat out. And unfortunately, about 62% of the outbreaks, foodborne outbreaks, are associated with restaurants or delis. And another 10% with with catering services. So a lot of our foodborne illnesses associate with eating out. And some of the other estimates, like 1 in 6% or about 17% of us will come down with a foodborne illness on an annual basis. So we do put ourselves in, as we eat out a lot, there's always that possibility of contracting a foodborne illness. And I might add one thing we haven't talked about. Paul mentioned that the risk may be low, but we can't forget about those other communicable diseases such as the common cold or influenza, which is, rampant in this during this time of the year. We may not be getting salmonella and listeria, E. coli contamination or foodborne illness, but we could be getting the cold from it, we could be getting influenza from it, and et cetera. So we can't forget about those organisms that are not necessarily associated with food, but are associated with humans and with contact surfaces as well.
Well, amen to that. Colds, flus, oh my goodness. Folks, you're tuned into the 1180th edition of the Food Chain Radio Show with Paul Dawson, who's a professor of food systems at Clemson University, with Brian Shelton, professor emeritus of food microbiology, North Carolina State. We're talking about all of those little bugs that we can't see. Some are friendly, some are not. How do we manage them? Do stay tuned. We will be right back.
Back for more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, there's certainly one thing that I didn't want to miss, because both of you worked with students. And one of the things we know about students is that they love beer pong. And you actually took this on. Brian, how did that work?
Well,
First of all, for those who haven't been to college, what is beer pong?
Well, it's as the name implies, it's a drinking game, and oftentimes played around sporting events, or can be played around sporting events. And since Paul is located in a well-known football community,
Clemson,
just won the national title. They decided that they would beer pong is essentially where you have a team of one or more people on each side, and you have a table that's set up that has half-filled containers or cups of beer. And the objective is to throw a ping pong ball over to a competitor's glass, and if it happens to land in that glass, they have to chug that beer down. And of course, if you're a better thrower and your competitors are not as good, obviously they're going to be drinking a lot more beer. And of course, most of the time these ping pong balls don't actually fall into the cup; they roll onto the surface of the table and land in, depending on where you're playing, outside on the grass or dirt, on the decks or porches, inside under on the carpeting. So we decided that one way to, in most of our studies, we'd like to, if possible, do some type of survey, topical survey on the topic. In this case, it was going out to the community. This happens to be on a homecoming football weekend in Clemson, and had these students take new ping pong balls with them, and in exchange for balls that were being played in ping pong of these beer pong games.
Oh.
And so there was a lot of different surfaces, ranging from what I said, outside surfaces to decks to wooden floors to vinyl to carpeting. And they exchanged these balls, brought them back to the lab, and then we cultured them for and determined the population of organisms that resided on these balls.
And what did you see? What kind of populations did you see there?
Well, as Paul said, in some of these other studies, you're going to see a considerable variation in populations. But overall, the overall average across all these different surfaces ranged about 76,000 organisms. And the place where you don't want to be playing to generate the highest populations were over 201,000. That was the outdoors. Whereas the carpet actually yielded the lowest value, about an average of 600. But one little statistic will kind of blow you a little, your mind a little bit, in that one ball, one particular ball, had 3 million, access to 3 million organisms on it. So.
And where was that being played?
Well, I don't know. Paul never gave me that answer. Maybe Paul knows. We'll divulge it. I don't know.
Probably a fraternity house is my guess.
Yeah, that was, yeah, we don't want to disclose any anything like that. No, it was outdoors. And I guess the other aspect is, as you mentioned, Brian described the game, how it's played, is that, you know, these services certainly made a difference, but also the hands, people handling
them.
Right. Probably more of a concern. And we will make the kind of the tell the story in the book where, you know, the longer you play the game, so one team's drinking more beer. They're both getting kind of inebriated, and they have to go to the laboratory.
Oh my goodness!
They probably have low concern of hygiene, and they come back and play the game after going to the laboratory. So, you know, that 3 million bacteria could be carrying who knows
what. There you go. Oh, what a sad story that. You know, in just talking with you, what flashed into my mind is one of our presidential candidates for the 2020 election talks about eating dirt.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I guess I'll pass that one. At any rate.
Well,
that's a good, that's a good point to bring up, because even in our book we talk about that, and that, you know, there's some people feel that today we're just too clean.
Right, right.
And that we're growing up almost in a sterile environment, which is not true. I mean, based upon what I told you initially about just we're covered with organisms. But their thought is that as when I grew up, you know, I probably ate my share of dirt.
That's what kids do, right?
And we develop maybe a more comprehensive immunity, a stronger immunity to more organisms. And as Paul pulled up a piece of data here showing that some communities actually want to infect their kids with chickenpox, so they take them to so-called pox parties, which the American Medical Association don't endorse. But again, the whole objective is to increase the amount of organisms that we come in contact with in order to develop antibodies against.
And what doesn't kill you makes you stronger.
Yeah, that's the question. Does it kill you first?
There you go. Well, I'd like to move on to go ahead, Paul.
Well, I just thought it was interesting, because a little history behind that is back in Louis Pasteur's time, he actually had because he developed germ theory, that germs enter the body and cause disease. He had a counterpart named Antoine Beauchamp, who actually had what's called the host theory, and his was that germs exist everywhere and they're opportunistic. So it turns out we know Louis Pasteur was right, germs do cause disease, but we're learning more that maybe there's truth in both sides, that, like I said, there is the microbiome, as Brian mentioned earlier, where there's a host, and they're very, our microbiome is very important in our health. And actually, unhealthy microbiome has been implicated in diabetes, cancer, allergies, asthma, and various things. So, and early on, he mentioned there are 10 to 100 trillion bacteria in our microbiome and on our body. So there's more and more work being done in that area, mm-hmm. as far as in the medical field.
A lot of exploration to be done. With respect to microbes in air and water, you did a great study on birthday blowing out the candles on a birthday cake. Paul, you want to start with that one?
Yeah, that was actually an idea my daughter had when she was in elementary school. We took it to the lab and did that. But that was, again, a fun one to do, because we had to come to develop a way to analyze the data or collect the data. And thinking about it, if you really have a cake there with candles on it, you blow on it, how are you going to analyze the bacteria? You can't put a whole cake in the we call it a stomacher and analyze that. So we actually developed trying to simulate as much as we could a birthday party. Went to the store and bought a foam circular diameter substance, and we put on top of there sterile aluminum foil and put store-bought icing on top, a layer of that on top of that, and then stuck candles through into the styrofoam, lit the candles, had the subjects blow the candles out or not blow the candles out, and compare those directly, either blowing or not blowing.
And how bad did it get?
It got pretty bad. There were,
Well, I can just imagine, watching the way some people blow candles out, that's pretty gross.
Yeah, he found as many as 37,000 bacteria on the blown candle cake versus not blown. So an average of 3,000 more. So there was a lot being blown.
So do you still blow the candles out?
No, you know, and it's interesting recently that we got a call about the Mitt Romney video with him pulling the candles off and kind of made fun of him. But actually, you know, and Brian mentioned earlier, he had a sore throat. So we talk about the common cold being transferred versus a common pathogen. That's, you know, one way it could be transferred if someone's sick.
There you go.
Certainly
folks, this is the Food Chain Radio program. We're right back after this quick break.
Let's go back for more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, you know, in thinking about the two of you and putting this together and the impact that you must be having on both students but also on your family, do members of your family chew you out for being too sensitive? Dad, stop it,
no.
Dad, something like that.
I have a lot of my friends, they've changed their, they will ask me, well, is this, should I do this or should I not do this? And, you know, it's impacted them. You know, it really comes down to, are they sensitive? Are they more on the germaphobe side or are they more on the careless side? And those on the careless side will continue to do what they do. And I think those that have a little more fear in themselves, obviously, will take what we have written more seriously. Mm-hmm. I mean, again, we've added humor to the book, but we did not want to dilute out the importance of the topic and that these organisms are easily transferred and some of these organisms are infectious in nature and can cause us problems. But for the most part, I think we're having an impact. I had one situation, and I'll quickly get through it, where I had an individual contact me via email and saying that, you know, her and her friend are on the germaphobe side, and she asked me if I would write a foreword. You know, her friend was having a birthday, and she wanted to give her this book for her birthday and asked me if I would write some, you know, some words. And their intent was that they would have impact on their husbands who were on the careless side. And we're hoping that the book and my encouraging words in the at the beginning of the book would have some impact on them. So it has impacted me in a couple of different places. I think for the most part, people who read it will take it to heart and see that, you know, the science is behind it. I did have some commentary saying that in some of these cases, well, how can you prove that, you know, blowing candles is going to cause a problem? But I refer back to the whole question about, you know, the Centers for Disease Control estimate 48 million cases of foodborne illness annually. But that's only an estimate because people don't go to the doctor. And how can you tell that you don't, you know, did I get that cold or did I get that flu?
And that does not take into account colds and flus either, does it?
Yes. No. And I assume that we may actually be having a greater impact or causing more concern for ourselves engaging in some of these practices from these other communicable disease, you know, be it colds or influenza, as opposed to foodborne outbreaks.
Huh. You know, it seems like if a germaphobe was to marry a slob, it would be kind of like a Republican marrying a Democrat, right? How would you possibly get along?
I don't know. Probably.
Paul?
I get that question about blowing birthday candles out, the same thing Brian said, is that how do you know anybody got any sick? And my answer to that is, well, as Brian said, we know that the common cold and virus, whatever, is transferred by bioaerosols from the mouth and sneezing and blowing. And so I would be willing to bet that the number of people who got sick from blowing birthday candles out is not zero. Because we know you're blowing air out, you're transferring that. If someone's sick, they're transferring to the top of the cake if someone eats the cake. So that's my response. I'm sure it's not zero.
Well, it's not only on the top of the cake, but it's in the air too, isn't it?
Yes, yes.
So,
and these aerosols, again, this exhale, the breath that we exhale contains this water vapor. These are very small water droplets, but large enough that they carry bacteria and viruses, and they can travel for quite a long distance. And in fact, one of our studies that we haven't got to yet deals with drying your hands using electric hand dryers.
They scare me.
And the question that Paul raised, are they just simply black bacterial blowers as opposed to really drying your hands?
And we're of course talking about the blow dryers for hands in public restrooms. I guess they're trying to save money by not using towels or paper towels. So instead they put these blow dryers in, and you have to press something, right? So all of a sudden you're engaged in the warfare before you even start. You know, one of the things I saw was how long that water vapor from our breath can last in the air.
Right. Yeah. And Brian alluded to that. And because the bacteria are about 1/10 or 1/100 the size of a bioaerosol droplet, and viruses are hundreds of thousands size smaller. So you can imagine how many can be carried on one droplet. That's how they transfer. There have been some studies done with the flu and different communicable diseases, and found, like you mentioned, they had people who were sick quarantined in a room, and these bioaerosols, these viruses, stayed in the air 30, 40, hour, or
30
more
or 40 hours?
No, minutes.
Minutes okay.
Hours,
So 30, so you're the better part of an hour.
Yeah. Right, it can be. And if someone's continued... Go ahead.
It also depends upon what kind of air circulation you have in the rooms.
Right.
Are there vents?
Right.
Are there circulating fans above? All these things can contribute to just movement of these vapor throughout the restroom or wherever you might be using this. And of course, the other thing: what do you do when you're in a restroom? You flush the toilet. And there's been a number of studies showing that when you flush that toilet, you're also producing these aerosols that are carried throughout that restroom. And then when you put on the hand dryer, again, you're helping and distribute or disseminate these vapors throughout. Such that the person who's drying their hands next to you may be spraying stuff that's either on their hands or what's coming through that.
Oh, my goodness. This is getting scary, folks. This is the Food Chain right back. Do stay tuned. Well, folks, it's a dangerous world out there for some of us. With all of these little micro buggies that are going around, my goodness, what are we going to do? One time in my life, I was in the U.S. Navy, living on an aircraft carrier in the South China Sea, down in the equator by Singapore. And it was the last World War II U.S. aircraft carrier, no air conditioning in the cruise quarters. Couldn't develop a better environment for bugs, I don't think. And yet, I never got sick on that aircraft carrier, nor did many other people. Now, cut away to latter years and going on a cruise. On a fancy ship with all of the fancy stuff, none of which was on the aircraft carrier, and it seemed like everybody got sick. What the heck is the deal with norovirus?
Well, it's this is Brian. And I might just mention that when the CDC, or Centers for Disease Control, the top five organisms that contribute to foodborne outbreaks, and leading the list is norovirus at about 58%, followed by salmonella 11%, and so forth. The primary culprit with norovirus is that it's generally associated with lack of proper hygiene, fecal contamination, to be blunt about it. And I guess I might say about you being in the Navy or the Air Force, I don't know which branch it was.
Navy, yeah.
Navy, that perhaps they just had better...
No, they didn't.
They didn't.
They did not. Sorry. They had the worst. So, I mean, everybody tried, but, when it's 90 degrees in a crew compartment and there's very little air circulation and it's just not clean at all. And you think about how clean, those cruise ships are. And yet when that norovirus goes through a cruise ship, it just and incredible. I lived on an aircraft carrier for a solid year, and nothing like that ever happened. So it's just one of those puzzles that I deal with all the time. So now we have you, the two smartest people in the world with respect to food safety and bugs. What should we do to survive? Paul, we'll start with you.
Yeah, you know, most of the things are common sense. As far as food, keep cold things cold and hot things hot. Wash your hands. I mean, one of the number one thing I think
wash
is washing
your hands.
Wash your hands, and that also relates. And I know Brian elaborated on this. This relates to like the part we don't know about is the common cold transfer due to what you eat and what you do every day. Is I'm very conscious of that now. When I touch a doorknob or a handle or rail when I'm in public, not putting my hands to my face, touching my ear, nose, or mouth. Because the matter of fact is, if when you get sick or someone gets sick, a bacteria or virus had to enter your body sometime, somehow.
Yeah.
If you think about it in that way, about when you carry on your daily life, that's probably a good practice. When you eat something, of course, you don't really, if you haven't repaired it, you have a little less control. And Brian mentioned the thing about eating out and the percent of illness there. But
right.
There
you go. Danger, danger, danger.
Yeah.
Brian, should we all become germaphobes?
Should we all? No. I mean, obviously, life is to be lived. And I think it would take the enjoyment out of life. I think what Paul has already said about this and being careful.
There you go.
Actually asking questions about, you know, should I engage in this activity or not? And again, knowing where you're eating
We just ran out of time, gentlemen, but thank you so much. The book, Did You Just Eat That? Thank you both very much. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.